From Missouri to Massachusetts, Arizona to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it's called the Farm Bill, but it is actually one of the largest welfare programs in the federal budget. Phil Kirpin of American Commitment is here to talk about possible changes to those programs. California is set to hold its primary elections, and things aren't looking as good for Democrats as initially expected. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. President Trump has announced he will extend tariffs on steel to products imported from Canada and Europe. Are we on the precipice of a real trade war? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And it used to be all politics were local. Now all politics are personal. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The so-called Farm Bill is much more than agricultural subsidies. It includes the massive food stamp program. Here to talk about issues surrounding reauthorization of this legislation is Phil Kirpin. Phil is president of American Commitment. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, when we talk about the Farm Bill and the fact that it's before Congress for reauthorization, tell us a little bit about the Farm Bill and what all is included in this legislation.
There are a lot of parts of the Farm Bill, Loman, but there are basically two sort of sides. There's the food stamp program, the nutrition title of the Farm Bill, they call it. And every time they do the Farm Bill, every 4 or 5 years, that becomes a larger and larger percentage of the total spending in the bill. I think last time it was about 75% of all the money in the Farm Bill went to the food stamps program. And under this current version they're debating in Congress, that's about 80%. So it's the overwhelming majority of the money that's spent in the bill goes to the food stamps program. And then there's sort of the other half of the Farm Bill, or the other piece, I should say, the 20% piece of the Farm Bill, which are the actual farm programs and all the various agricultural subsidies and the price supports and the giveaways and the subsidized crop insurance and all of the other things in there to support farms and farming. And the way they've historically always gotten farm bills through Congress is they have the food stamp program to get the urban members to vote for it, and they've got the farm subsidies to get the rural members to vote for it, and they pass it with a big bipartisan vote, is typically what's happened historically. A little bit different situation this year because for the first time they're putting meaningful work requirements into the food stamp program, very modest ones, I would say, but meaningful enough that Democrats all took a walk. And so zero Democrats voted for this farm bill because they opposed those work requirements when it was up on the House floor, and the vote actually failed because a number of conservatives voted against it because they wanted to do immigration first. And so it's going to be interesting. The House will probably come back to it in late June, and then, of course, we'll have to see what happens with the Senate and so forth. So the current farm bill expires at the end of September, and so they'll have to either do a short-term extension or find a way to get this all resolved before then.
As we look at this, and let's talk just a little bit more about these work requirements, what we're talking about here, to be clear, is able-bodied, able-minded individuals required to do either work or be in a work training program. What could possibly be the reason for opposing something as simple as that? And in fact, didn't we have something similar passed back during the Clinton administration?
Yeah, this is similar in many ways to what was done for cash welfare back in the 90s, the old Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, which was turned into a block grant to the states. And there were basically no federal rules other than one. You had to have a work requirement, which was basically the one rule that was put on the states when that program was reformed. And it was very successful because what happened is people who wanted cash welfare had to work for it. And many of them saw that since they had to work anyway, they'd be better off getting off those programs and making more money and kind of going up the ladder of economic opportunity. And so what Republicans are trying to accomplish in this farm bill with the food stamp program is basically putting similar work requirements in, actually much softer in some regards, because they're requiring only for the non-elderly, non-disabled population that does not have young children at home. They're requiring a work of 20 hours per week or participation in a job training program as a condition of being able to get food stamps is the way they wrote the language for this. And the logic of that is people need assistance. They need to be on the food stamp program. They ought to either be working or trying to better themselves to prepare to be able to get work so they don't end up living long-term on food stamps. So they have an incentive to get on that ladder of economic opportunity and get off of assistance and sort of move up the ranks. And the other positive of this from a broader perspective is we've got a big labor shortage in this country right now with unemployment at 3.9%. So if we can get people off the sidelines and back into the workforce, that'll help a lot of businesses that aren't able to find anyone to fill positions right now also, which will be good for the overall economy. So it's a smart policy and I think a very good time to do it. And yet, pretty remarkably, every single House Democrat voted no on this bill over specifically the work requirements for the food stamp program. Even Democrats that have always voted for every farm bill ever voted no over this specific issue, which is remarkable in light of polling that shows the public overwhelmingly supports it. I saw one poll in particular from the Foundation for Government Accountability that found that over 80% of the public supports these work requirements and over 70% of Democrats support these work requirements, and yet zero Democratic members of the U.S. House were willing to vote for a bill that included them. And so I think their reasoning is this is just a way to cut food stamps and we're against these cuts that are cruel to the poor and all that kind of language. But I think that most voters understand that it's not being cruel to people to tell them you've got to work or prepare for work to get to get assistance in the form of food stamps, that actually benefits people to get them into work and onto that ladder of economic opportunity.
The other 20%, as you pointed out, are actual farm subsidies. One thing that struck me as odd is that even if you don't live on a farm, if you once lived on a farm but no longer live on a farm, you can still get hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in subsidies. How in the world did that come about?
Prior to the 2004 Farm Bill, there was no residency requirement at all. It didn't matter where you lived. If you qualified for one of the many agricultural subsidy programs, and you know, there are lots of subsidized crops with all kinds of different programs, if you qualified, if you had an ownership stake in a farm, it didn't matter where you lived, you could get the subsidy payments. And there were a bunch of negative press stories about all kinds of well-known urban dwellers, you know, like TV anchors and random people who lived in New York City and so forth. They were collecting all this money in agricultural subsidies, and it was kind of scandalous and hard to defend. And that outrage, that backlash, led in 2004 to the Senate adopting language that was really strong, that basically said to get any agricultural subsidies, you have to live on the farm. That was the language that passed the Senate in 2004. But it got watered down to where if you didn't live on the farm but were the immediate family member of someone who lived on the farm, you could still collect agricultural subsidies. So that's what the law is now. This proposed House bill loosens it up even more to where you can be a niece or a nephew or a cousin of someone who lives on the farm, and if you have an ownership share, you can collect agricultural subsidies even if you live in a city. I think that is a terrible policy. We should really go the other direction to the full ban and say farm subsidies are just going to be for people who live on the farm if we've got to have them at all, and I guess we do because of politics and what have you. They ought to be for people who actually live on the farm.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin, who is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us just a little bit about American Commitment. Where also can folks go to read more about the Farm Bill and other key issues?
We are a national free market advocacy group. We work on really all of the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and all of our information is on our website at americancommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin, again, president of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us.
My pleasure, Loman. Have a good one.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, Andy Roth is keeping track of what's happening not only under the Capitol Dome in Washington, but also in the 50 states where we have primaries and all sorts of electoral activity taking place this week. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
We'll start out by going to California, which is not really friendly territory, to say the least, for Republicans, but we have an upcoming primary there. Democrats hope to make major gains, but they might not get the blue wave they expected.
California is what it is, and it's very blue, very Democrat territory. Also, another thing that harms conservatives and Republicans is that they have open primaries, which allows Democrats and Republicans to all run on the same ballot. And that usually results in Democrats winning or very moderate Republicans. When you have a closed primary where only Republicans can vote to pick their nominee, then that allows Republicans to typically choose the most conservative Republican that they believe can win. So that's a very good thing, and open primaries kind of ruins that. So it's no wonder that a lot of the Republicans from the California delegation to Congress are very moderate. So that's a problem. But because the Democrats are all wound up against Trump, that has resulted in a lot of Democrats running for Congress. And if you can imagine just any given House district in California, and you see a lot of Democrats and only a couple of Republicans, that means that that Democrat vote gets split up so much so that only one Democrat could get into the November runoff, or maybe no Democrats at all. In fact, there's one seat, Dana Rohrabacher's seat. He's a Republican. He's an incumbent. He's in a very purple district, and he was once considered vulnerable, but because there are so many Democrats trying to run against him, he may end up making the runoff with another Republican. And in that case, whoever wins that is going to be a Republican, obviously. So that's a good thing. The other thing is that Republicans have successfully got a gas tax repeal initiative on the ballot in November. And they plan on spending a lot of money ginning up the turnout for that. And then they've also found a candidate for governor who, while I think everyone concedes would likely not win the governorship, spending money on that race could amplify the turnout as well. So Democrats thought they had a great opportunity in California, and now it seems very much less so. And let me make one final point. All of the political pundits believe that the way for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats to regain the House, they have to do very well in four or five states, and that includes New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and California. So if California does not go along with the rest of those other states, then Pelosi may not get her majority back. So it's a very interesting thing to watch.
Speaking of the United States Congress, let's talk about efforts by the Trump administration to pare back some of that massive spending that was included in the omnibus bill earlier this year. How does that process work, Andy?
Trump really hated that $1.3 trillion omnibus bill, and so did most fiscal conservatives. He signed it anyways, but he threatened that he was going to veto the next one, and he's making sure that everyone on the Hill knows that he's going to veto that. But in the meantime, he has tasked Mick Mulvaney, his OMB director, to find pockets of money within the huge monster federal government that's being unspent and unwanted, if you can believe that. And there's a lot of evidence that there is some money that can be rescinded, so to speak. And so the Trump administration put together a package of these spending programs that he wants rescinded. It's unclear how much they total, but it's, I think, between $11 and $15 billion, which is really just a pimple on the overall federal budget. But it's symbolic in that they're trying to get rid of spending that shouldn't be there. And so they've put this package together and they sent it to Congress. And under the Budget Act, Congress has 45 days to act on it. And basically all they have to do is take that package, vote on it in the House. It requires a simple majority. In the Senate, it requires a simple majority, not filibuster proof. And if both chambers pass it, then it becomes law with the president's signature. A lot of pushback is happening on the Hill. Naturally, the Democrats are against it, but even some Republicans like appropriators and defense hawks are against it, and some moderates too. But if you look at these spending programs, like one of them is the advanced, I'm going to get the name wrong just because it's a bureaucratic program. It's like the Advanced Technology Loan Program for vehicles or something like this. And it was a loan program created, I believe, under the Obama stimulus that gave corporate welfare to automakers like in Detroit. But Detroit doesn't want it. The strings attached are too onerous on them. So that money's just sitting there not doing anything. So if the recipients of such a program don't want it, then let's get rid of it, especially since it's clearly unconstitutional from my viewpoint. So let's get rid of it. But the big spenders are so addicted to spending that they don't want to even do that because that might create momentum to find other pockets of money hidden somewhere else in the budget. So the deadline for this is June 22nd. And this is entirely on the Republicans to pass. They've got the votes in both chambers to do it. But if the appropriators or the moderates squeal, then it's further proof to the voters that Republicans are not the fiscal conservatives they claim to be.
How does this impact then the ongoing budget process? Because at the end of September, theoretically, there should be a budget in place. It never happens, but should. Does this rescission effort impact that at all?
It doesn't. It's a sideshow, but it's a very important sideshow. The budget itself, the appropriators are busy with their spending bills, and they're going to go through the motions. They're going to act like they are listening to President Trump's veto threat, and they're going to try and pass these individual spending bills. But come September, they're almost certainly going to admit that they can't pass anything because they don't have the votes or the political courage. So that will force them to put together another omnibus bill. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the group I work for and a lot of other groups and a lot of voters are going to stand with Trump and urge him to veto that bill. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Speaking of the group you work for, tell us a little bit about it.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Tariffs on steel imported from Canada and Europe threaten to trigger a wide-ranging trade war. To learn more, we have this report from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Over the past 3 months or so, I've been thinking a lot about the First World War and about the geopolitical background to the war. Specifically, I've been thinking about something that Christopher Clark says in his excellent book, The Sleepwalkers, which is all about the beginnings of and the sort of the underlying causes of World War I. And I've been thinking about that because of what's happening with our current trade situation. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at the announcement made Thursday by the White House that America would be going forward with new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from some of our top trading partners, including the EU, Canada, and Mexico. And so I've been thinking about this in the context of the First World War. And I'll try to explain why. Hopefully you'll bear with me. Most Americans learn that the beginnings of the First World War are rooted in the assassination of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And like many historical facts, that's only partially true. Ferdinand was gunned down in the streets of Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, but troops didn't actually mobilize for war until late July, and it was actually the middle of August before the real shooting began. The intervening time was filled with a flurry of diplomacy as various factions encouraged or dissuaded the war. From the perspective of June 28th, it's really not clear at all that the conflict was inevitable or that it would be anywhere near as significant as it turned out to be. Indeed, even a month later, it was nearly avoided as England and Germany, two countries that had very little to do with the direct cause of the war, the assassination, and had every reason to avoid a prolonged bloody conflict, nearly reached an agreement that likely would have prevented a full-scale conflagration from erupting across the entire continent. In other words, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand did not make the war happen by itself. It didn't make it inevitable, even. But at some point during the 6 weeks between the assassination and when the conflict actually started, the scales did tip from improbable to possible to inevitable. And that's what Christopher Clark talks about in Sleepwalkers. As Clark writes, from this it would follow that the conflict was not the consequence of long-run deterioration, but of short-term shocks to the international system. So like I said, I've been thinking about Clark's analysis of the First World War quite a bit over the last few months because the contemporary world's great powers have been moving closer and closer to a major trade war. And with the announcement Thursday that the White House will press forward with these tariffs on imported steel and aluminum from Canada, Europe, and Mexico, it seems that President Donald Trump has taken another step towards that precipice. Now, the analogy only goes so far, of course. Thankfully, there are not millions of lives at stake in the decisions that will be made in Washington and Ottawa and Brussels and Berlin over the next few weeks, but the stakes are still pretty high. And like in 1914, a trade war between the major economic powers of the globe in 2018 would threaten to smash an international system that has, despite some obvious shortcomings, worked pretty well for the better part of half a century. A trade war, if we have one, is not the result solely of the Trump administration's economic nationalism or the assassination of domestic businesses. Trump's trade policies are just another short-term shock to the system, and there's plenty of blame to be spread around for those other shocks. Some of it should be shared by China and other countries for sure. Still, the inciting incident for the coming trade war will be remembered as the Trump administration's announcement in early March that there would be tariffs on steel and aluminum imported into the United States. That kicked off a 6 to 8 week period of diplomacy, with the White House agreeing to exempt several major U.S. trading partners from those tariffs until May 1st, with the goal of reaching some sort of bilateral trade deal before then. And in some cases, that worked pretty well. Deals are in the works with countries like Argentina, Australia, Brazil, and South Korea. But even a longer extension until June 1st did not bring Canada, Europe, and Mexico to the negotiating table. But now the clock is really ticking. At midnight on June 1st, the exemptions for Canada, Mexico, and Europe will expire. And Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said this week that they will not be extended. A trade war that seemed improbable, or at least only possible, for weeks is now slipping closer to inevitability. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker called the tariffs unjustified, and he says that the EU is preparing countermeasures. According to the Wall Street Journal, those countermeasures will target some $3.3 billion in U.S. exports. American agricultural goods are expected to take the biggest hit, and that's bad news for farmers who depend on export markets because America literally grows more food than we can possibly consume. Trump has preemptively responded to the expected European response by threatening additional tariffs on imported cars. Investors and businesses are getting hit too. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell sharply on Thursday after Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced that the tariff exemptions for Canada and Europe would not be extended. And steel-using industries have reported significant price hikes since Trump first announced the tariffs in early March. Now, all the sides are still talking to each other, and that means there's still faint hope for some sort of last-second deal, but that looks increasingly unlikely. Now, the tariffs on steel and aluminum, don't forget, are being imposed under the administration's vague and unfounded claims that foreign metal somehow undercuts America's national security. The White House is already gearing up to make a similarly silly argument for tariffs on cars, but how tariffs on European cars and Canadian steel will address the administration's big concern, which is the trade imbalance with China, don't forget, that still remains somewhat unclear. And that lack of clarity, or if you prefer, that lack of honesty between the Trump White House and America's top trading partners, is compounded by the administration's decision earlier this week to pull the rug out from under a proposed deal with China. After first threatening to impose tariffs on some $50 billion of Chinese imports, the administration said less than 2 weeks ago that those tariffs would be put on hold because they were working out a deal with Beijing. And then the Trump administration abruptly reversed course this week, apparently surprising Chinese officials in doing so. Now, negotiating for peace in a real war or a trade war becomes incredibly difficult once trust is lost. A state of uncertainty makes the improbable, unnecessary conflicts more likely to happen. That's exactly how we ended up with the First World War, as Christopher Clark concludes in his book. He says that it became inevitable not because of an assassin's bullet, but because of a profound sundering of ethical and political perspectives that eroded consensus and sapped trust. And unfortunately, President Donald Trump is walking the world to the precipice of another major conflict. It will be less bloody, but it will be no less tragic for its pointlessness, because right now it doesn't seem like the Trump administration knows exactly what it hopes tariffs will accomplish. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our coverage of free trade and tariffs and the Trump administration and everything else at Reason.com. Pick up our latest edition of Reason Magazine on newsstands now, and we'll be right back here next week with another edition of American Radio Journal.
In the era of Donald Trump, politics have become very personal. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about the polarization of the electorate on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Have you ever seen our political system in as much turmoil as we're currently experiencing? The closest that I've seen in my lifetime was during the 1960s at the peak of the Vietnam War controversy. The divisions between those who opposed and those who supported our involvement in that war were deep, but once formed, relatively fixed. Most people were in one camp or the other. But in the Trump era, large segments of the populace swing from opposition to President Trump to support of him and back again, and these swings occur from week to week. There's a new and very simple phrase that I think captures the dominant variable in these swings. You'll remember the famous saying of former House Speaker Tip O'Neill, "All politics is local." While it didn't truly apply to all politics, it became a truism because it was widely perceived as true in so many circumstances. The new phrase applies to the age of Trump, and it's this: all politics is personal. Trump loyalists are loyal to him because they are bonded on a very personal basis, and almost nothing will break that bond, including vulgarities, intemperances, or remarks that are seen by others as racist, misogynist, or xenophobic. Trump opponents of the sort that have lawn signs or bumper stickers that say, "Hate has no home here," are so repulsed by the president on a personal basis that no support from him for any favorite issue will convert them to supporters of him personally. Between these two camps of hardened support and hardened opposition is perhaps as much as 20% of the American electorate, and they are being driven half crazy by a president whose actions they applaud one day and condemn the next. They love to see him take on the proverbial Washington establishment swamp. They love a fighter from the outside who represents the ordinary voter who has no lobbyist holding sway in the halls of power. They want America to be strong, both economically and militarily, but not mean. They applaud him when it looks like he may succeed where his predecessors failed in reducing tensions with North Korea after having increased them briefly, but they are uncomfortable when they hear him refer to immigrants as animals, even if he was limiting that comment to gang members. They share his concern that the FBI may have been politically motivated in investigating him, but they want the full truth about any dealing between the Trump campaign and the Russian government or Russian companies to come out through the special counsel's investigation. This 20% block of voters is looking for someone to trust. Can they trust the president as a leader with integrity who is trying to fix a broken system? Or do they conclude that he's a fast-talking flim-flam artist who says whatever he thinks he needs to say at the moment, regardless of whether it's true or not? These are good people who don't want to wallow in the details of policy and diplomacy. They just want to feel that they can trust the man in the White House and the party he leads. As one who voted for Donald Trump, I want to continue to believe in him, but it gets a little harder every day. I can distinguish my support of the president from my vote for Senate, Congress, state representative, and so on, but I think that for many voters in the middle, their vote for these other offices in 2018 may well depend on whether or not they trust Donald Trump. Trust is a fragile commodity, and once broken, it is not easily restored. If they conclude that their president is the liar that many in the media say he is hundreds of times per day, then they will personalize that conclusion on many, if not most, Republicans in November. All politics is personal in this, the Trump era. This has been Colin Hanna for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXBR-FM in International Falls, Minnesota, KTIA-FM in Des Moines, Iowa, along with WRRN-FM in Warren, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.